This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And listen, it's your research and it's your investments. You analyze markets, you manage risk, but did you research your broker? In 2025, IBKR's clients outperformed the S&P 500. Yep. Retail clients averaged 19.2%, while hedge fund clients averaged 28.91% compared to the index's 17.9%. IBKR's lower trading costs, competitive rates, efficient execution, and access to more than 170 global markets helped investors keep more of what they earn and put more capital to work. Over time, the broker you choose makes a difference. Interactive Brokers member SIPC. If you care about performance, find out why the best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers at ibkr.com/2025.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Greenland babble sinks and then boosts markets. Natural gas prices skyrocket. Small caps continue to lead markets. And our guest today is Jeremy Kassler, founder of Cass X. Yes, we're talking about whiskey, all this, and much more on episode number 957 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey there, kids. Andrew Horowitz here, and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Another great week in store for you. And yeah, we have a guest on, and guess what they sent me? He sent me whiskey samples. So we're going to taste some while we're talking to him about this interesting idea of ownership of whiskey, bourbons, rye. Yes, that's something you can do. I've been looking at this for a long time, wondering about it. So I have so many questions lined up for him that is going to be a good time. But let's talk about what's going on in the markets right now. Well, natural gas prices. Why? Well, that snow that's about to befall this huge swath of the United States of America is going to be covered in icy, cold conditions. And what we saw was that the Henry Hub U.S. benchmark, this is the natural gas prices, went berserk, skyrocketed. Surging over, I don't know, it was like 70% at one point. I think it settled in at about 30-something percent for the week ending the 23rd. It was the week ending the 23rd this week. And that's pretty amazing. Reaching as high as about $5 per British thermal unit. And this is pretty incredible. This marks the largest weekly gain. Listen to this. Since 1990 and the highest price since 2022. Again, this huge Arctic blast, that's what's causing a lot of this. Most severe weather we've seen in years hitting most of the U.S. And hopefully you are taking care to make sure that you are safe. A lot of flights are canceled. A lot of ground stops being seen. A lot of people saying, just to hell with this, I'm not traveling. I'm not going outside. I'm just closing the doors. I'm doing the heat on and I'm doing our thing. We're going to see all those horrible stories about people doing strange things like bringing their barbecues inside the house and all that. But what we saw was a massive spike in the heating demand as households are cranking up the thermostats. And that is just in front of this whole thing. Because gas, I don't know if you know this, but gas heats about 47% of the homes in the U.S. and powers a huge amount of electricity generation. So both sides, right? Whether you're getting heat by electric, whether it's your water heater, whether it's your heat in your house, that's coming maybe from electricity or maybe even natural gas. Yes, some of you use heating oil and you have those giant furnaces in the basement that are cranking out that loud heat. And some of the apartments around the country are still using steam heat that is based on furnaces in the basement. Maybe from heating oil, But all of that is part of this process, and that is going to be a bit of a crimp on pricing over the next couple of months. Expectations of depleting storage is very high. And there's this big issue they're talking about now, the potential for production disruptions, right? Because of these freeze-offs where water is freezing in wells and pipelines, especially in Texas and other areas, is also reducing supply at the worst possible time. Well, of course, when else would it be? So this is creating a tight near-term supply-demand imbalance, and it amplified this short squeeze for people that are investing in it, or maybe not investing only, but it's maybe some of the places that are looking to hedge their positions as well from the power company standpoint. And all these traders that were bearish or short on gas earlier had a rush to cover their positions as forecasts turned to this colder, horrible weather. But these events, they don't last forever. We've seen this kind of weather before, this action in weather that has done things like, whether it's hurricanes, and we talk about this on a regular basis. Sometime in May, we pick up a company a lot of times due to the seasonality of it called Generac. Generac is a company that, and actually, if you look at Generac over the last few days, it's done very well. It's a battery or a company that does generators. So generators and holds some storage and then charges your whole house up. This is very similar to what we see in the hurricane season and the wicked weather season of the summertime. And every time there's a storm or there's a discussion of a storm or a prediction of something coming our way, Generac seems to get a little bit of a lift. Buyers come in. This is exactly what happens. Then if we have a really tough season of either no storms at all that were really significant enough for people to say, you know what, I need a generator. I need to replace my generator. I need a new generator. What happens is that unless there is a huge amount of new houses being built that will be built with generators, Generac usually comes down after the summertime, after hurricane season. Let's talk about October, November, and it troughs and kind of hangs out for the year. And then we see maybe even a roll-off downside. And then sometime again in May, the seasonality kicks in. With this kind of weather event that we're talking about right now, it's very short-lived. Now, there could be more things heading into the winter. We're just starting. But the reality is that this kind of event, this Arctic blast, sometimes they look at the polar vortex. These are things that are temporary and short-lived. Let's keep an eye on this just for the fun of it, shall we? In terms of the price of natural gas. Watching if maybe the storm isn't as severe as we initially thought. But this is something that is a really good lesson to learn and understand. And we could take that and really expand that as well into even what's happening with AI right now. Quantum computing. The risk on sentiment with certain areas that are getting bought up and short squeezed. These things don't usually last forever. And there is a natural cycle. It deals with the psychology of the markets. It deals with how we are like disbelievers, then believers, then, oh my God, I need to get in. And man, let me just throw everything I have at it. And oh my God, what a mistake I made. And then, oh boy, I'm going to be ruined. It's going to go. And then it goes up and down, the peak to trough. This is an economic reality. It is a financial investment reality. We've seen it time and time again. That will not change. When we're talking about something as near and dear to us as our own money, the investment cycle is going to be there. It may elongate, it may enlarge. The peaks may be higher, the troughs may be lower, or vice versa. We may see a thinning out of that, and we may see even a time period where right now dips are bought in a matter of a day. Look what happened with Greenland last week. President was huffing and puffing and talking about how, you know, under no circumstances like, am I going to remove these until we buy Greenland. And we knew it. Literally, we were talking about this in the office that, you know, let's not panic about this right now, because I think when they go, the ensemble gets off the planes and the helicopters in Greenland or in Davos, actually, to talk about Greenland. And shake hands and meet and greet, there'll be a magical framework of a deal that will be created that nobody will have any idea what it actually is, but it'll be a great deal. And then the tariffs will come off. And markets will react. Seem like something that we've seen before. So keep an eye on natural gas. Keep an eye on what's going on. I don't think the Greenland deal is really a deal at all. It's just, you know, we're just going to allow to have better the dome, maybe, of course, in the Arctic, I guess, and possibly even some more security there. But I don't know how much mineral rights we're going to get that we wanted for the whole country, but we'll probably just get what was due us anyway. Everybody will get all excited that it didn't get any further. We can't go anywhere else talking about things like today. We have to talk about other economics. And by the way, we saw a GDP number come out. We saw an ISM services number come out. We saw initial claims. Really not much changing. We saw even a PCE number come out. Everything's kind of status quo. And I think that is a good thing for markets. Nothing's too bad. Nothing's too good. It's just right down the middle. Now, I mean, we did see some productivity in GDP numbers and expectations that look like we're going to continue to have really good growth moving forward. So that's good. Employment numbers, strong, relatively, where we should be. Consumer spending down, consumer spending up, personal income down. Not a great combo right there. That will play out over the next couple of months with consumers. Sentiment in line with where expectations were for the week. There's still that K-shaped economy issue that's going on right now. And we can't go any further also unless we talk about silver. Do I have this here somewhere? I think I have, don't we have it here? There we go. Somewhere on the board, I knew there was that. Give him a big round of applause. I mean, silver hitting 100 on Friday. 100. It was up huge last year. It's up 41% this year, which is, by the way, 3 weeks old. We talked about this at length on DH Unplugged this week. Myself and John C. Dvorak on Tuesday nights where we're live. We talked about this and talked about some of the reasons and rationale. I was also fielding some calls from colleagues and clients on this week, talking about where to go. You have questions? You know what? There's a place for you to go too. You can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click on Ask Andrew. There's a little button on the top that says Ask Andrew, and ask me whatever you want. The email comes right here, right to the studio, right to the offices. There's a studio in the offices. And there's a mailbox that says Ask Andrew. Magically, it appears. So go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com right now and ask away. Before we get to guests, I want to talk also about last week, some of the things we talked about. We talked a lot about earnings season. And this is right in front of us right now. The potential we have, I think, for either this idea of a stretched valuation market and disappointments, or prices still have room to run to fill the future opportunity. That's kind of where we are right now. And I don't think those two sides are much different. And I think that where we are in terms of investor sentiment, which is high and hot, and allowing for most companies to believing that we have a lot more room to run ahead of us is something that's, I think, there. Some companies, like we saw this week, had some problems. Some companies that we're worried about, the Microsofts, Dells, a few others down, you know, a chunk, others down 10, 20% over the last month or so, as the concern about CapEx spending is a big issue and whether or not we really are ahead of our skis right now. We've already seen some of the prices come down. But I don't think that most investors right now or institutions are ready to throw in the towel just yet, just by the looks of market action. Intel reported this week it was a miserable quarter forward. They met their revenue expectations. They did fine on earnings, which was, you know, low numbers generally speaking. But I don't think anybody was surprised about there was going to be a little bit of hiccup in here, right? Because the only reason the stock took that massive pop was that it was propped up by who? Uncle Sam or Big Daddy, whatever we're calling it today. You know, the stock was hit by guidance. It was down about 15% on Friday after a pretty stellar run. And this is something we may want to watch. Is this the canary in the coal mine? I don't know. You know, we've seen incredible runs on MU, AMD, all the peripheral companies, we'll call non-AI, but the companies that are powering the machines that have the AI also, as well as the automation when it comes to automobiles. And I guess we'll go back to the old Cisco term of thinking about the Internet of Things, IoT, and what's happening with devices, even like washing machines, toasters. Look, I got a new oven coming in, and I got to tell you something. I am going to have to spend time looking at the book, the instruction manual. I have one that's your basic. You turn the knob, it's 350 or whatever it is. Great. This other one, I got to tell you something. It's like a whole computer system. It doesn't just push a button and turn on like the old days. So we have some concerns about the companies, and we've been seeing the sluggish nature of their shares, like the like I mentioned, Dell, Microsoft, been down for a while. The big issue is what's going to happen when Apple reports. That's what I'm thinking about. Because if we have the prices for hardware that have gone up so much as there is an inventory problem, right? We've seen the prices of all of these, you know, this is a supply and a demand problem. It's both sides of it. With the chips and all that. That all goes into where? Into an Apple device. And that is something we need to keep an eye on, because it's a very big possibility that we're going to see a margin crunch moving forward. Everybody gives Apple a relative buy on a lot of things, but now they have the AI situation figured out, which is not their own. They're going to use Gemini, right? They're going to use that for Siri. But they have a lot of hardware. They have a heap of hardware they sell, and that hardware requires other hardware to make it work that is a lot more expensive hardware right now. So that's something. And markets, well, the S&P equal weight is beating the S&P 500 so far this year. That says a couple of things, right? One is the possibility that it's a rally that's broadening. Or maybe even the big names are pulling things down. I don't know. You can look at it either way. But we know that the small caps are on fire. And as I was reviewing portfolios this week, we're pretty pleased. I got to tell you, it's pretty good with our updated allocations and the positions we have currently in both small caps and in EM, emerging markets. Wow. And there's a question I was thinking about as I was looking at this. I was thinking, you know, I'm going to talk to everybody on the podcast about how much emerging markets do you own in your portfolio? Think about it. And how is it owned? Is it dollar denominated? Is it in local currency? What countries is it in? Because we make some specific positioning when it comes to that. We have positioning in EM that favors China, for example, and there's some that favor, let's say, like India, right? Two of the majors. Then there's some that are in local currency fully, partially, or even hedged back into dollars. Which one is the right one? And if you're thinking I just have emerging markets in my portfolio and that's it, that's all I have to do, I mean, come on. There's a lot more involved in that. And as a disciplined investor, you need to understand where it is that you have your positioning. We spent an inordinate amount of time creating portfolios for clients and understanding the intermarketplace of how it works, of where we want to be and for what reason inside, even down to the currency exposure and to the actual sector, country, and sector exposure of that country inside of the portfolios, inside of those particular assets. So an ETF that just says, is it emerging markets? I got to tell you something. For a long time, there was an ETF that was the emerging market play that was like, I don't know, 60% Brazil. That's just dumb. You know, you could own things like an ETF or a mutual fund that is in Japan equities. Great. You did great, right? Oh my God, look how great Japan it did. Was it denominated in yen or dollars? If it was not denominated in yen, you lost a great chunk of your gains. You erased them, obliterated them, because the yen has been weakening dramatically. Again, this is something that you should know before you just own a pooled investment. And these are things, again, I'm going to say it again, you should know as a disciplined investor. And if it's too tough for you, I get it. It's not easy to find out all this information. Or maybe you just don't have the tools to do it or the desire. That's possible too. I get it. This is something where you need to understand, but if it's that difficult, I get it. Where you need to understand how it works in terms of risk for your portfolio and how these work together and what the expected returns will be on that position, find an advisor that can help you with that. We're in a new year. Maybe it's time to take that leap for the future. Maybe it's time to take that leap for the future, your financial future. Get a second opinion. You do it with doctors all the time. You don't just bring your car and go, okay, how much is it going to cost? You shop around a little bit, you ask. With your portfolio, you're the only one doing it right now. Maybe you should bring in a second opinion. Something to think about. Something to think about. All right, before we get to our guest today, I have something to say. And that is about Interactive Brokers. Because there's a question that tags along what we just discussed. The question is, what's driving your portfolio's performance? Have you ever thought of that? Ask IBKR. Ask IBKR is a breakthrough AI-powered tool from Interactive Brokers and lets you interact with your portfolio using plain English. Ask a question and get an instant, data-driven answer about positions, risk, and returns. It's built right into the IBKR platform, too. Check it out at ibkr.com/ask because the best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Now, our guest coming on today, yes, we're dealing with booze, we're dealing with whiskey, we're talking about bourbons and how to actually invest in them, which is kind of cool. But I have a couple of bottles right here. You can hear them swishing around right there. Some sample bottles that were sent and a really nice snifter. And we're going to check those out as we talk. But our guest is Jeremy Kassler. He's an entrepreneur and an alternative asset innovator with more than 25 years of experience in specialty finance, alternative assets, and corporate strategy. He is best known as the founder and CEO of CaskX, a global whiskey cask investment platform that launched in 2019 to merge his passions for whiskey and his background in building pioneering investment ventures. We could do that, right? Let's try to check that out. Nothing wrong with that. Yeah, he founded it in 2019. It was launched in 2020. Built momentum and pretty interesting thing. So CaskX is, they manage like 30,000 casks over valued over $50 million, serving 700 plus investors worldwide. Operating in Beverly Hills, Louisville, Sydney, Hong Kong, London, Toronto, and Des Moines. I don't know how that got in there, but in Des Moines. Let's welcome our guest right now. So, Jeremy, glad to have you. I'm glad you're here. How are you? What's happening?
Yeah, thanks very much for having me. Yeah, great to be on the show and looking forward to some amazing chats.
So, you know, we don't usually talk about booze very often. In fact, I want to set the stage for a moment. This is the Booze Show. Where I have a few samples that actually CaskX sent me. They sent me some beautiful brochures and information about the whole process. But somewhere in this discussion, maybe we'll start up front too, but well, let's get to the background. We're going to crack two of these small little sample bottles and put it in the, what's the right word? The bourbon snifter, the whiskey snifter.
I think that'll do.
And taste them and talk about it. But let's talk about you first, because I'm kind of interested in you. You started selling things as a kid. This is part of your story. You know, you sold hot dogs, which, okay, that's a thing. You know, people talk about selling and delivering papers, newspapers, you know, but you sold hot dogs and wrapping paper. I don't know if you wrapped the paper, the hot dog or the wrap paper, and eventually, you know, built this major venture in art and whiskey. Take me through the early days of the, you know, baby Jeremy entrepreneur with the hot dogs that you're selling somewhere, and then to some of the things that you're doing now.
Yeah, I mean, I started very early. I left school very, very early. I felt, you know, at the time that really education was not my way forward, if you know. And I think that's important for a lot of people that, you know, you shouldn't just be judged by your academic results. Some people fit, you know, different profiles, have different journeys. And I, yeah, was from a very early age, from sort of 15, 16, was entrepreneurial. You're right, I started off selling initially Christmas wrapping paper. I think that was the first thing that I sold on the street, 8 sheets for 50 pence at the time, and so on and so forth. And then I kind of moved into hot dogs because obviously it's less seasonal. And
did you have a cart? Did you have a cart, some kind of a hot dog cart?
Or a wagon? Drive my wagon up to near Marble Arch in London. And, you know, I'd start work at 9 p.m. And work through till 4 a.m.
Oh,
And you can only imagine some of the people I met, some of the sights. It certainly gave me at a very early age a lot of life's experiences.
Yeah.
Some very, very interesting people.
Now, before you got involved in the current venture that you're involved in, you were dealing with art. Now, I have a little bit of a history with art. Yeah. I took some in college, took a bunch of art courses, always enjoyed them, been to a variety of the museums around the world, including the ones in your home country, as well as all over Europe and plus places in Egypt. And, you know, there's art and there's history and there's all that somewhere in between, right? There's that, that thing, which art obviously tells of our history, right? It's a wonderful step through time of the culture and the appreciation. You founded something called the Art Futures Group, which became a major broker in Chinese contemporary art. How did that happen?
that's a good question. Well, I'll go back a little bit before that. So I initially entered the world of alternative investments with wine. And I was living in Sydney, Australia at the time. I got a job with a company that sold wine for investment. I very quickly realized that this was a business that I could probably launch myself. And we found a great market in Singapore. So myself and my business partner, who's a colleague, we said, right, we're going to start our own business. We're going to do marketing into Singapore because red wine at the time was just kind of exploding. The Asian palate was changing from, if you like, lots of spirits to red wines, etc. So we started a business and we launched a great business and expanded. And after about 7 or 8 years, we sold the business. And I took a year off. I took a gap year, late gap year.
Right.
Most kids are students when they say gap years. I was a little bit older.
And I want to take a gap year.
Yeah, no, anyway, I was based in Asia, and I traveled to Hong Kong for the weekend just to renew my visa at the time. And I couldn't believe the amount of wealth in Hong Kong at that time. It was around about 2010. And every shop, there was queues around the block. Everyone you saw had shopping bags with Hermes and Prada. And it just felt like a place where I should be. Because I've always had this idea that, you know, you can be smart as anything, but you need to put yourself where the money is. And Hong Kong at the time felt like, right, that's where the money is. I couldn't enter the wine business because I had an understanding when I sold the business that I wouldn't compete. And I thought to myself, well, what can I sell? And someone kind of suggested to me, look, people buy art for investment. And I completely started from scratch. I knew nothing about the art world. I was an art lover to a degree, but I did some research. We realized that you know, good mid-career art pieces tend to go up in value over a period of time. And the Chinese contemporary market was booming at the time as well, with all this influx of new Chinese money. And so I think there were 10,000 apartments every month being built in Shanghai alone.
Yeah.
And these apartments were $1 million plus. So they all needed to be fitted out with nice artworks, etc. So we decided to sell art for investment. And everyone said, you'll never sell art over the phone. It's not possible because all the galleries were poo-pooing the idea. And we created a really successful business selling Chinese contemporary art to investors over the phone in Hong Kong.
Wow. Sight unseen.
Yes and no. I mean, of course, with the internet now, we were able to, of course, we were sending images. But part of the reason for the success of the business was we set up a rental program. So, for example, someone would buy an art piece and then we would keep the art piece and we would rent that art piece out to a bank or whoever, you know, an office in Hong Kong. And we would share the proceeds from that. So it enables...
It's like somebody buying a boat and then renting the boat as a charter.
Yeah, because one of the issues would have been that in Hong Kong, there's only so many art pieces you can put on your wall because most people are living in small apartments.
Right.
So we set up the rental side, which enabled investors to buy 20, 30, 40, 50 pieces if they're needed, and receive a dividend every quarter. So it's more like a property purchase where you kind of receive a rent and you get the capital growth as well.
I love that. That's cool. That's cool.
There you go.
So when you sold that, how did you then find the next thing that you were going to do?
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, over the period of time from selling wine to selling art, although there were different products, the idea is the same. It's a passion investment.
Yeah.
And people are investing into something that they, you know, that they really love and that they enjoy. So before we sold the art business, we began to get inquiries about, can we source whiskey? And this came out of nowhere, you know, just one day, first person asked, and then a few weeks later, someone else asked.
Was this primarily out of China, though?
This was in Hong Kong.
Yeah, because they're big on, they love whiskey there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
No, love.
I mean, China, also India, believe it or not, India is the highest consumer of whiskey on the planet.
Yeah, I was there, actually. It was either beer or whiskey.
Yeah.
There was, like, no wine. There was, like, no wine that was good.
Yeah, that's right. But a lot of local whiskey.
Right,
but anyway,
right,
that's
right.
Another story.
Kerosene.
So we began to get these inquiries, and we're like, okay, this is piquing our interest. And we looked at the market, and then we're like, yeah, this would be a valid business, but I was so focused on the art business. And then when I sold the business, it was a natural progression. We looked at the market. There were a number of whiskey investment brokers in the UK, primarily because most people were selling stocks for investment. And of course, you know, being local, it was easy to source. And we looked at it and thought, right, we're going to sell whiskey for investment. And then, of course, the next question was, where are we going to base the business? And we looked all over the world. Of course, the first port call probably would have been Hong Kong. But then we thought, hang on a minute, there's a huge market here that doesn't have any whiskey investment brokers in the US. And that's where we are. We launched the first business, selling Scotch originally. And then very quickly, of course, our American clients were saying, look, can we get bourbon? So we reached out, had a few meetings in Kentucky and Tennessee, and now 95% of what we do is in the bourbon market in the US.
Wow, that's great. So let's talk about bourbon. Let's go forward and come back. Let's talk about the idea of investing in bourbon and why and how. And we know there's been a lot of things that have happened recently. There's a lot of geopolitical issues that have happened. We had a big flood in Kentucky I can see the bottle. It's part of the Sazerac. There was a big I can't remember. I'll remember the name. Anyway, there was a huge problem there, and all the barrels were spent, gone. But talk to me about investing specifically in whiskey and casks and the life cycle from purchase to payoff. Kind of take me through the beginnings to the end.
Sure. So we, as a company, will go out and we will do deals with distilleries. So we will reach out to Jackson Purchase, which is one of the bottles you're...
Yeah, I got it right here. This is a newbie.
Wonderful distillery. I could talk, you know, the reasons why we highlight or target that distillery. One of the reasons would be that Craig Beam is the master distiller. Beam, I'm sure you've heard that name. Fairly well known in whiskey circles, but he's in the Bourbon Hall of Fame, something like sixth generation master distiller. So we look at the people behind the whiskey, not just the whiskey. So then we go out and we'll place an order for, say, let's say 2,000 barrels of new make bourbon or new make whiskey. So in other words, we will place an order for those barrels to be filled on a certain date. Normally, you know, so many first quarter, second quarter, third quarter, etc. We will then reach out to not just our client base, but obviously potentially new clients as well. So look, we have this offering. It's new make bourbon, which is what you're also tasting today, which is like clear liquid. And we will sell those in smaller quantities of, say, 50 barrels here, 100 barrels here, you know, less than 2,000, obviously. All our investors are accredited investors, which they have to be for SEC purposes. But we will then sell them the 50 barrels. We include 8 years of storage and insurance in the purchase. Now, that's obviously very important because the whole premise of investing in suburban is that it increases in value over time as it ages. So that there's very few assets that, you know, regardless of market conditions, if market conditions stay exactly the same, that asset will be far more valuable after 8 years than it was after, you know, day one. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, as you can taste for yourself today.
Let's talk about that. So this is a new make, which means pretty much it's distilled and put in a bottle.
Yeah, exactly.
There's nothing softening this.
No.
And it says the mash bill is 65, 25, W, and 10. I'm assuming there is some wheat in there, I assume, in this one? Is that what that means, yeah. The W?
That sounds like a high wheat. So to be a bourbon of any description, it's got to be 51% corn. So it's always predominantly corn. But you'll have, that sounds like a high wheated bourbon without being there and tasting it.
Right. And then there is high wheated bourbons. And there's also things like, I mean, one of my favorites, I'll just throw this out there now, just get it off, is there is a Weller 12, which some people call the baby pappy. And I've had it many times and it's impossible to get in Florida. And we did get a bottle recently. And if you want to buy it, it's $50. If you want to buy it on the secondary, it's like $250 to $300 for a Weller 12. I had it as a drink that somebody mixed in Manhattan in when I was in Texas, and I'm like, what is that? That's delicious. Not really, couldn't get it. But this is much different. I'm going to just tell you, I've had this before. I'm not having this one again. Okay. This one smells delicious, by the way. It smells absolutely delicious. This is clear. It's a bourbon. It's kind of like if it was a baby, it would be the fetus. Okay. Am I right?
Well, no, you're right. You're exactly right. I mean, it smells great, but it tastes.
Oh, my God. It tastes like rot gut.
Yeah, it's quite shocking, but it's all about the barrel. So everything that creates the flavor is because of the barrel. If it was in a steel vat and aging, it would taste exactly the same in 6 years, 8 years, 10 years.
But it also loses some of its proof, doesn't it, over time when you have the evaporation, or what do we call it?
The angel share. The
angel share, yeah. Which tell people what that is, but not everybody knows what that means.
Well, the angel share... you can talk in approximate terms, sort of 3 to 5% would be lost by way of evaporation each year. And it depends on the climate, of course. In summertime, it will be more, wintertime, less. But the angel share essentially means that there's less liquid in the barrel, but the flavors become more intense. So,
and the first thing to evaporate is the high amount of alcohol content. That evaporates a lot faster than water.
Yes, that's right.
So you have this evaporation. That's why if I tasted this right now, I did taste this yesterday, actually. And if I taste that right now, it is shocking. It is totally different from the smell. The smell is literally delicious. And I'm smelling it right now. It has a lot of cherry, a lot of sweetness, a lot of sugary smell. Mm-hmm. It smells almost like a grappa, to be honest with you. Very much like a grappa.
And it looks like a grappa.
Looks like a grappa, which is obviously made from the grape skin. And grappa is also very shocking when you drink it. After the first sip, it goes down very easy.
Almost like a fruit ripening.
Yeah.
You know, if you get a really ripe banana, it's kind of sharp and kind of bitter to the mouth. It's not dissimilar. So over time, it becomes more mellow. With bourbon, you can age it for, 20, 25 years in some cases. Scotch even longer because of the climate. We've got a bottle here that's 72 years old.
And the other one that I have, which is going into a class right now. Hang on.
Yeah.
You heard that go in. Is a 5-year-old 100 proof from Old Glory. Now, we talked about this. I described it to you, and let's talk to everybody. I see the nice legs hanging out on the side of the snifter. very slowly moving down. Very nice. I describe this with many different factors, and let's, for the hell of it, tell people. Do I know anything that I'm talking about when it comes to bourbon?
Doesn't matter. Your opinion is the most important thing.
Well, my wife doesn't say that. My wife does not say that.
As long as you enjoy it, then your opinion is...
I'm going to take a little bit of a snort of this 5-year-old. And this is one of the makers that you invest in and then you have available.
Old Glory, in Tennessee, basically. But you've got a perfect example there.
That's good. That's delicious.
Two bourbons. One is 1 week old. One's 5 years old. And that is the process in a nutshell. That if you just leave it alone in a nice, dark rick house, don't do anything. Just let the climate do its job and let the barrels contract and the angels share, go up into the heavens. Then after 5 years, 6 years, 8 years, you have a more valuable asset than it was day one. Because, you know, nobody's going to drink what is essentially moonshine, or nobody in the retail market.
Well, I'll say nobody.
might be a few people out there would, but it becomes, particularly after 5, 6, 7, 8 years, you've got something that is sought after, not just in the States, but internationally, and carries a very high value.
All right, so I'm going to be a client. Here we go. So take me through how this looks. First of all, I'm assuming you have to be accredited for this. Correct. So I have to be an accredited investor. And I can give you X amount of dollars. I don't know what the minimum is. Let's just use a round number for the heck of it, $100,000 for, again, just examples here. I'm gonna say that obviously we know that the difference between the 1 week old that I have right here and the 5 year old, which I just tasted, is night and day, right? There's a delicious factor. I'd like to drink it just like Pappy would, by the way, with a drop of water and maybe a little lemon. That's how Pappy himself would drink that. Just open it up a little bit and let it just speak, or maybe even one ice cube. I like a one ice cube. I'm a one ice cube.
Okay. One big one.
One small one. I like one small one just to make it like a cold drop of water to dissipate slowly. Sure. And by the way, folks, if you are drinking, this is my opinion, and I'm going to push this on everybody right now.
Yep.
Ice comes in different sizes and shapes for a reason. If you put crushed ice in a glass and you pour the whiskey over it, it's going to immediately melt and it's going to water it down. That may be the way you like to drink it, so be it. You put regular ice cubes a little slower. You put a fat, big, frozen ball in there, one ice cube, it's going to take a very long time for that to go. And then you go even further. If you just want to cool, you can put whiskey stones in there, which are just cold rocks or pieces of metal that are, that are sanitized, just to make it colder for you to drink, per se. And that's a way to drink it too. So I'm usually a large rock guy.
I like the one big, I like the square.
Yep, exactly.
When you've got an old fashioned.
Yep, exactly. So I give $100,000. What is the general time frame on this?
Yeah, so like I said, we include 8 years of storage insurance. So, you know, legally, you have to hold on to your investment for at least 1 year. That's SEC guidelines. But you know, nobody's buying one-year-old bourbon barrels. So when we get to years 4, 5, 6, then we see the supply reducing a lot. There's very few bourbon barrels aging on the market that are 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. And the market would be, or the secondary market, is most bourbon brands don't actually make their own bourbon. It's not like Scotch, where you see the name of the distillery, and generally speaking, that's where it's been made for the last 300 years. If you go to your liquor store, probably at least 50% of the bourbon brands buy the barrels in aged, bottle them the following day, and then sell that as their blended product, if you like. So,
but they won't tell you that. They say it's their own. Except for, larceny. Larceny. Yeah. You know, larceny will, the whole point of, I think, the name of larceny, that bourbon, is that they stole the recipe from somebody else and they rebottled it. That's the point.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
But yeah, so a lot of the, previously, a lot of the bourbons came from MGP, which is in Kentucky, it's in Indiana. So you know, it's there's a lot of marketing involved. But what it means is that for people or investors who are holding 6, 7, 8 year old barrels, they've got a valuable asset, and there's a lot of demand because, as I say, there's very few aged barrels in the marketplace.
So after that, you're basically, you said you could, you're including 8 years of storage and insurance. Are you actually, do you actually have warehouses, or are you leaving them at the distillers for a period of time? Because they, you don't just get a barrel and let it sit. They got to work it and they got to taste test it and all that, right?
Yeah. No, that's right. So no, we leave them at the distillery. So it's a little bit like with wine, that the provenance is very important. So if anybody's going to buy, 50, 100, 1,000 barrels for their brand, they want to know, of course, they're going to try and test it and taste it, but they want to know they've been stored correctly. So you couldn't get a better storage facility than where it's made, because like anything, the less travel, the better.
Yeah. And what about the insurance? That's an interesting thing, because the name I was trying to think of before was Buffalo Trace. Buffalo Trace had a big flood.
Yeah.
It ruined a ton of the bourbon that they had, and a variety of their, I think they do Blade and Bow. They do a variety of different brands there. What does the insurance cover? How does that work?
Yeah, no, we everything's covered by Lloyd's of London. So, of course, this is a highly combustible element. Interestingly, if you go and visit the distillery, you'll always see by the front door, it could be like, 40,000 barrels in there, and they have like a pocket-sized fire extinguisher by the front door. And it always, I know, it's ridiculous, but we have to have it. But obviously technology's improved these days, and there used to be a lot more people smoking, I guess, which was one of the main risks.
Wow. That's like smoking in the gas station. It's crazy.
Yeah, everything's fully insured. And, if worst came to the worst, there's a fire or a flood or a tornado, then the barrels are replaced, fully replaced, and we provide another 8 year storage. Yeah.
So what's been the rate of return over the 8 year cycle?
Again, we can't, there's no guarantees, but what we've seen historically is somewhere around about the sort of 12% per annum mark, something
net,
like this.
Net to the client?
Yeah. So in the double figures. So, the reason people invest, well, there's a number of reasons. One, of course, for the returns, like any investment, how much you're going to make. But there's other elements to it. So people are looking at healthier returns. It's a very safe investment. It's tangible. It's something that we actually provide VIP tours. You can actually go and visit your barrels. So every client, hopefully at some point, goes to visit the distillery, meets these amazing people that are producing these brilliant bourbons, stirs the corn, et cetera, et cetera. And they appreciate them. They can actually see it with their own eyes and touch it and feel it and taste it. So there's that safety issue. It's, asset security, if you like.
No, it's tangible. It's
real.
And it's probably when the lights go out and the bunkers get closed at the end of the day, when you come back, probably easier to barter with a bottle of good old, bottled in Bond 100 than it is to try to get some gold off.
Yeah, no, yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, it will always carry value. It's never going to be something you wake up and, oh my gosh, it's the market's down and it's got no value. But I think almost 50% of the reason people love to invest is because they really enjoy bourbon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really nice to be able to invest into something that you're passionate about.
What are your top distilleries?
I think there are top distillery, Jackson Purchase.
Mm-hmm.
Would probably be of one of our main ones, Bardstown, quite a famous, well-known distillery, obviously Bardstown in Kentucky, Green River. I would say they're the top four. Old Glory's is a great one that you've got there. You've got a five-year-old. That's mm-hmm. one of our main ones in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to stick to primarily Kentucky and Tennessee because it's kind of, the path of easiest resistance. We're not looking to find the next amazing distillery. We're looking for distilleries with a really proven track record that when it becomes time to exit, and of course we can, should the client wish, we can help them to sell the barrels, of course. Most clients do. We charge a 5% brokerage fee. But yeah, we're looking for the distilleries that are easiest to sell when they're 8 years old in, 8 years' time.
And Bourbon made a big move. I mean, tequila's taken over a little bit right now. I mean, Old Fashions became extraordinarily popular. I'm, by the way, if you want to ask me, I'm sure you're dying to know, what's my drink of preference, right?
Go on.
A traditional Sazerac.
Lovely. Okay.
So bit of absinthe, dusted glass with with Pinchaud's bitters, a little bit of one sugar cube that is muddled, and throw Sazerac itself rye over that with a big ice cube after stirred. That's right what I want.
Beautiful. I mean, I like an old fashioned. I'm into
good old fashioned. Obviously, with that. You know, I started making my own bitters.
Oh, right.
I have a whole bitters kit with all sorts of really strange things. Like,
you can make bitters. I wasn't aware.
Yeah. Maybe I'll send you a little bit of those.
Okay. Yeah, return the favor.
I just made a batch of chocolate bitters, actually.
Okay. They're lovely. Right. I'll look forward to those.
So what about geopolitics, tariffs, things like that, trade wars? You know, you had a situation, have a situation right now where Canada said thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah. No, that's right. So, look, you know, tariffs come and go. The whole political scene, you know, when one country stops buying bourbon, the focus goes on other countries and the marketing budget goes elsewhere. So it all tends to even up in the end. And, you know, this is part of the reason why we include 8 years storage, that if you look at the reality, over 8 years, things almost always sort of balance out. So what you don't read about is the good news. Like, for example, India, which, as I said before, is the biggest market in the world for whiskey, slashed the tariffs by 100%.
Yes,
that's smart. It was huge. It was 150. It's down to 50. Hong Kong, which is, of course, the gateway to China, which is also, as you can imagine, a huge market. They completely took away any tariffs on whiskey. So you tend to hear the bad news, not the good news.
No, it's good news. But you also find there is some really interesting trends going on, though, that must be something that you're looking at, which is the slowdown in drinking in the next generations. You know, I'm very involved in a particular club down here that it's a yacht club. Everybody knows that. And, I get all the stats from them and from all the different clubs around Florida, around the country. And it's an interesting trend that people are looking for, first of all, alternatives to drinking for the same result. You know, they're looking at cannabis and various drinks like that. But there's also, forget Dry January, there's also a trend for the next generation, whether it's cost or whatever, to go to RTDs, the ready-to-drinks. You know, they just get some junk in a can. I'm not talking about beer, by the way. I'm talking about some other something.
Oh, no, yeah.
That by the way, started out not even as real alcohol. It was you know, some of the stuff that first came out was basically a fermentation. Well, alcohol is fermented, but fermented. It wasn't real vodka. It wasn't real tequila. It wasn't real bourbon. But there's that going on. That's happening, isn't it? But again, it may be cyclical, I guess, right?
No, it is. I mean, it's cyclical. I don't know how to say that word. But you've also got premiumization that's taking effect as well. So, you know, the fact is that people are becoming more fussy and more choosy about what they drink. If you go back, you know, 15, 20 years, it was Jack Daniels, or it was, you know, Jim Beam. It was those sort of generic brands that, you know, you go in a liquor store, you might see, you know, 6 or 8 brands. Now you'll see 100, 200. And the quality is going up. The time that the barrels are being aged for, importantly, is going up as well. So people are drinking less people are drinking, but what they are drinking is of a higher value.
Yeah, because you look at some of the brands, some of the core brands like the Makers, which has been there forever, right? But they have a higher level brand. Look at Four Roses. Four Roses has a really crappy, cheap, but drinkable bourbon, but they have their small batch, which is wonderful.
Yeah, and you're seeing more and more aged offerings as well. You didn't used to see many age statements on bottles, but now you're seeing more and more is following the Scotch, where 8, 12, 15, 20 years.
Yeah, that's good stuff. You know, I find that the idea of alternative investing in some things. Now, you know, there's different types of alternative. There's hardcore alternative, but there's also investing in other things than the basic things that are out there, right? The stocks, bonds, ETFs, and even real estate for that matter. There's something to be said about investing with your passion. A lot of people have a passion to drink, by the way. A lot of people have a passion. Look, I have a lot of friends that have, we went through bourbon together. I stayed there. Bourbons and Rye's. They're onto tequilas. And there is, talk about a selection. Tequila is absurdly different. It seems all the same to me, by the way. And tequila can get really pricey. I mean, bourbons can get pricey too. You know, most bourbons are kind of that middle of the range, though, even good ones. Tequila gets absurd.
No, that's right. But very quickly, no, you're right. I mean, you know, it's very easy to pay $1,000 for a bottle of tequila. We see $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. But yeah, a good tequila is in the hundreds of dollars, whereas a good bourbon is, you know, $80, $100, $150. You can pay a lot of money for bourbon, but you shouldn't.
So now you said that people will get to see, touch, feel, meet where their barrels are. I mean, if I was to enter into this program, I'm buying multiple barrels, right? I'm not buying one
that's
barrel.
Right. At least 50 or 100,
I mean, I'm going to be on a piece of 100 barrels. That's the point. I'm not buying 100 barrels. I'm buying a piece of it.
No, you're buying 100 barrels.
Me personally?
You're buying the actual barrels, yeah. So, you know, like I say, if we source, say, 2,000 barrels in 1 year from the distillery, we'll sell 50 barrels to yourself, 100 barrels to somebody else. So you'll physically, those barrels will essentially have your name on it.
You were in a pool.
No. Sorry, I should have made that clear. So you actually own the barrels themselves. So, you know, you decide. There's no decisions other than yourselves on how they're stored, where they're stored, when they're sold. You own the actual barrels. Those barrels have got your name on it. And when you sell them.
While barrels can cost a big range, I get that.
Yeah.
What's a barrel cost? Give or take.
We're around about $2,400 for new make.
That's it. Well, it's new make. Right. Because if you buy something that's done, it's a whole different thing. It's a compounded, let's call it, you know, we got to say at least X amount, which, you know, the compound, listen, you're going to get 12, I'm going to get 12, but it may be a compound of 20 because you got to cut the cost of the storage, the production, the fees involved and all the other people involved in the deal. So you're talking about that, you know, going up by a magnitude by the time it's actually drinkable.
Yeah, I mean, we would expect, and again, there's no guarantees. We can't give actual projections, but we look historically. But, you know, 8-year-old barrels would sell, you know, somewhere between $6,000 to $8,000, something like that.
And how many bottles are in a barrel of 750 mils?
That's a good question. I mean, it depends how it's 50 gallons, which is about 200 litres. So when it's bottled, more than often it's brought down to 40% proof. So you would be looking at around about
80 proof, 40% alcohol.
Yeah. So around about say 300 bottles.
300 bottles, right.
Yeah.
And when it's bottled, do I get to get one of the bottles in the end?
I mean, you can keep them all if you like.
I could keep the whole darn thing if I want. Keep the barrels.
We are actually launching a barrel pick program as well. So, because our clients generally, if they buy 50 barrels, they sell 50 barrels to keep it simple. But we are launching a barrel pick where you can actually buy one aged barrel and we'll bottle it and create a beautiful logo and, you know, a personalized bottle for you. Mm.
What's the minimum investment?
The minimum investment is 24 barrels. So it's about 56,000.
Mm-hmm. And that's all in to start, or is there an extra piece on top?
That's everything. There's nothing more to pay. Like I say, the only time you pay anything more is if you want us to help you to sell the barrels, which you probably will, then we'll charge a 5% trading fee generally after the 8 years.
Right.
But yeah, everything's paid up front. There's no weeklies or yearlies or taxes or
anything. Right, because otherwise I gotta take the barrels. Come on, Andrew, pick them up. 24 barrels. What are you doing?
That might be a challenge. For most people, because you know you've got 8 years in storage, you might as well use it.
Yeah.
So most of our clients are saying, I'm going to hold for 8 years and then sell it.
Good stuff, Jeremy Kastler. I appreciate you coming on, informing us, educating us, and I'll take a little bit of a sip again before. Hang on. Good stuff. About whiskeys, bourbons, and the idea of alternative investing. We're going to have information on the show notes, episode number 957 on thedisciplinedinvestor.com to get to caskx.com. So you can find out all sorts of information on what's going there and how to get involved if you so choose to. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for joining me. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right, thanks.
Goodbye.
All right, I'm taking the rest of these sample bottles. We're going to finish those up, and then we'll come back next week and see how it goes. Thanks for joining me this week. Thanks for joining me every week. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Click on the Ask Andrew. Let me know what you're thinking. Love to hear from you. I'll respond right back to you with comments and my thoughts. Thank you for joining me again. I'll see you again next week. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz.